Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Radulski, with my co-host, the strongest endocrinologist in the world, Marcus Pex. We're bringing on a special guest today, Dr. Alyssa Olenek. Not Olenek, it's Olenek. I confirmed that before we did this. She's a PhD and has her training in exercise physiology and actually did postdoc training in menopause and training, all sorts of stuff. She is literally an expert that we wanted to have on because I saw some of her posts recently talking about body composition changes while going through perimenopause and menopause. And this is a big topic because there are a lot of people out there spreading what I would call pseudoscience and misinformation, basically to sell their own services and products and to get their own fame.
That never happens.
Around this specific topic. And this is the Docs Who Lift podcast. We care very much about exercise and lifting weights and body composition and longevity and quality of life. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you guys for having me on.
Yeah, short notice, by the way. We were like, All right, we need to get her on. And then it was just by chance she was open to come on here with us. So
I just set up my office literally yesterday. So you guys are lucky. I just moved. Perfect. So you caught me at the right time.
Amazing. Perfect timing.
Yeah.
Serendipitous, I think. What got you into, like, obviously you've been exercising for a while. You have this really cool program, the LIST method. You're a big time promoter of exercise. You did an exercise physiology PhD. What got you into the whole menopause scene?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm like a lifelong exercise junkie. Like, there's no one who's been more obsessed with exercise than me since I was a teenager. And you know, as the story goes, when I was younger, I was like, I want to learn as much as I can about this and just share with everyone. Like, I just thought it was this magical, amazing, incredible thing. And I just really wanted to learn as much as I could. And I really kind of took that to the nth degree. I kind of got into research in undergrad. And in my master's, I kind of indirectly fell into women's specific research. I didn't know that there was these research gaps. I didn't know that there was like all of this confusing this and that. I had some amazing female mentors who were doing women's metabolism and pregnancy research. And they just like took me under their wing. And then I kind of carried that with me into my PhD, where I did a little bit more stuff on like sex differences, menstrual cycle, birth control. And so what I really wanted to do, though, is, you know, continue my training after my doctorate in the area of menopause, because one, women spend like a third of their life peri postmenopause. Two, that's where we're seeing a lot of the changes with metabolic health and or, you know, body changes and or functionality changes. And I really wanted that breadth and depth of the lifespan for women, not just focusing on the premenopausal, but like really that whole lifespan of women's metabolic health and exercise function. So I wanted to kind of take that PhD training just a little bit further and, you know, spread that across the entire lifespan. I was a female athlete growing up. I'm a woman. 90% of my followers and clients are women. And so I really cared about that enough to just keep going and going and going.
What was your sport?
So I played lacrosse in high school and then a little bit in college. And then I quit because I had the highest GPA and the lowest playing time is my kind of shtick there. And I also did cross country and indoor track for a season. And so post sports, I've continued to run and do a lot of like ultra running and hybrid training type stuff. But yeah, lacrosse was my big thing.
Yeah, you're pretty jacked, dude. So you do a lot of like ultra training and lifting. You're quite the hybrid athlete there.
Yeah, I kind of got into the hybrid scene before it was like cool to be in the hybrid scene. I was just a power lifter who missed running and then it became really popular ahead of the time.
LIST method. That's the LIST method.
It is literally what the LIST method. It was born of me. I was doing a one-on-one training and I had all these women who were told like, you can't run, you shouldn't run, you can't lift and run, you can't do both. And I was like, oh, you guys don't not trust me because I'm a beefcake. You like me because I'm a beefcake who runs. And I kind of just like literally ran with that. And that's exactly what my programs are, is just and it's just like, that's just standard training for health, right? Like that fits into the shadow of this podcast, like combining cardiovascular and resistance training. Like as an exercise physiologist that and an athlete, that never seemed super radical to me, but to the fitness industry in 2016, 17, 18, that was like, you were in your bucket and you stayed in your bucket.
I was going to say, cool. I mean, what you'd, it's like any, you say that kind of thing to any type of athlete and they'd be like, well, of course. Duh.
Yeah.
That's what you do.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That is so cool. So, and then you, the, what was your, what were like the studies or research that you did in like your postdoc and your PhD?
Yeah. So in my PhD, I was really interested in like exercise metabolism. And I did a lot of like postprandial metabolism in my master's and my first two PhD studies. So I was interested in like the concept of like metabolic flexibility, or essentially like if you overload someone with a high fat meal, can they increase fat oxidation or shift substrate to like handle that? And then I kind of wanted to capture that like in exercise. Is that because you know, theoretically metabolic shifting is a component of exercise too. It's not just a nutritional thing. And so I essentially like did some studies comparing the two and looking at the two and then looking at that like metabolic flexibility or metabolism or cardiorespiratory fitness across the menstrual cycle or with birth control during high intensity interval exercise. So that's like my three studies were a mix of like actually my first PhD study was a postprandial metabolism following the high fat diet. Healthy templates that you guys made years ago. So full circle moment here.
Wow.
And then looking at, you know, then I wanted to dig a little more granular. I got funded to do like women specific and sex specific research, which was great that they even had that at UGA. So I was able to like buy myself out of teaching and really focus on those studies on like sex differences and the menstrual cycle and birth control. And then my postdoc work is still waiting to be published. Science is so slow. But that stuff was really cool because, you know, the data is finally here. We had a long, hard journey of some of the core labs getting us like, you know, some of the data that we needed. So I can't say anything too much to that yet.
It's embargoed.
But it's cool though because it fits in the conversation of like, cortisol and body fat. And essentially it was a microdialysis challenge, putting microdialysis probes in the subcutaneous adipose tissue of postmenopausal women where we were like hormonally manipulating them, or a whole body cortisone challenge on and seeing basically like, is any of that related to changes in adiposity? Obviously you can't take a sample of visceral adipose tissue, but we do have like DEXA and CT scan and stuff like that. So right now we're like in data scrubbing. We finally got these labs to get us back all the hormone data. You know, it was just, there was a lot of obstacles there. So it's a lot slower, but I'm hoping that stuff will finally be out because that's so trendy, right? Is cortisol making us fat? How is it related to that?
Our favorites.
Like, it's funny because that study, you know, my PIs put that in before I even started my postdoc, right? And then COVID kind of slowed things down. So I'm excited to see like what the data looks like there, if there's any relationships with those things. So that's the stuff that I worked on with that. And then I helped out with some other studies looking at like, we're under review right now for a paper comparing like CT to DEXA on like body composition change over time for visceral adipose tissue. Can it track it over time or not? And there were women that were premenopausal, but were like artificially suppressed to be postmenopausal over time with these trials. And things like that. So resting metabolic rate, body composition, are these things changing when you hormonally manipulate women? So we're waiting on getting some of that data, but we're finally working on those papers. But really that training for me was about learning more techniques, getting more exposure, doing more menopause specific work. I got trained under two really brilliant mentors who have been in these fields for years. And I got to do like metabolic chamber stuff, doubly labeled water, things like that. So it was really cool. Yeah, it was really cool to like get my hands on more of those like higher end testing that isn't just like indirect calorimetry.
Yeah, there are a few basic like conclusions from your studies, you know, barring anything you can't really say because of embargo or whatever. But any little basic bullet point conclusions that you can share with us from your studies that people can learn from?
Yeah. So when I think about my dissertation studies, which are published and people can find and read, what was one of the most interesting findings that I did see that was a trend of all of my studies that I think it's left out of the conversation when we think about, at least in premenopausal women's fitness, is that when we think about metabolism and, you know, exercise performance or exercise metabolism or all these things, it's like we see a bigger difference when it comes to like baseline fitness status rather than like menstrual cycle phase, contraceptive use, anything like that. So the women that were more aerobically fit in my studies were better fat oxidizers. There's this narrative that like women by nature, like you're born, so you're great at oxidizing fat and you have all these type 1 muscle fibers and you don't have to do anything. You're just better at it than men. And you know, there are some of these like acute cellular muscle fiber differences, but like it's still a training response and a training effect. And some women still respond to that. So a big conclusion of most of my studies is that there wasn't these big differences of cardiovascular fitness or exercise metabolism that were driven by menstrual cycle or birth control. It was coming from fitness status. And even in my first study that like looked at sex differences in postprandial and exercise substrate metabolism, so fat oxidation, the sex differences like really weren't a huge difference. It was like when you broke them, and they were really small sample sizes, so this was like more preliminary, like it looked like it was more of a fitness status difference in the women, even in that as well. So my bias is that like being fit is more important than any of these other things when it comes to like women's fitness and the response, which makes sense, right? A fitter, more capable person is going to be better at utilizing fuel or stronger or more fit or more capable. Like it tracks with what we know. So that's like my TLDR of like all of my studies is it's probably more matters. You're like being fitter matters more than probably anything else for women. And we have all these little myopic conversations of these tiny things that when you control for just training and getting fitter, it really doesn't matter quite as much.
So speaking of language, get started early, be consistent, don't get lost in the complexities.
Oh, and it's never too late to start.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Just do it.
Yeah.
All right. You're speaking our language. Let's, I want to dive into like some hot topics here. Mm-hmm. Training between men and women. So you kind of just alluded to like, you know, like you just kind of train, but are there, if you're a woman, and we'll get into whether perimenopausal or menopausal, if there are differences there. But what about men versus women? Should you train differently?
So I probably get put under fire more often than not by saying that women would benefit more if they train like men more frequently. And then a lot of the current marketing towards women is just taking men's fitness and pinkifying it. We're saying women have been, it's pinkified protein and weights. And we're saying women haven't left that and out of research studies.
You got to get a creatine in a pink packet. Yep.
And it's funny because me and my friends, it was a COVID project. We did that Invisible Sportswoman paper. Like I'm the second author on that. And people like misquote it to me all the time or try to use it against me. They're like, women are left out of sports medicine research. I'm like, I'm the second author on that paper. I know that it's a gap, but like that doesn't mean there's no research, right? But in the research we do have, like just saying we don't have research, let's make stuff up, doesn't mean that like when we look at the research we do have, we don't see that, you know, we see that when you control for baseline, like strength and muscularity, women gain muscle and strength similar to men. If anything, maybe a little bit more, probably because baseline, they aren't as traditionally trained, right?
Right.
There's less engaging participation in teens and young women and women across the lifespan in like especially resistance training, things like that. And so I get kind of put under fire sometimes where I'm like, if you train more like men, right? Men lift weights, they do like appropriate doses of cardiovascular training that isn't just like hit under fire 6 days a week, right? And they usually just like chug a protein shake and like, you know what I mean? Like they not every dude, but like if you think about like the really bro-fied version of fitness, it's like that. I mean, that's how I train, right? Like if women do that, so it's really
to your point before though, I mean, that's how female athletes train too. I mean, I've known female athletes my whole life. I mean, this is not like female athletes isn't a new thing now. It was new kind of for our parents' sort of generation a little bit and before them, I think, but. I mean, we obviously went to high school and college with high level female athletes, and everyone was doing that stuff.
Athletes,
right?
Yeah, and so that's why,
right?
You know, to finish what I was trying to say before I got tangent is people say, well, women are left out, so like they try to fill that gap with hypothesis, rather, or they say women have been left out, and that's why you need lifting protein and creatine. I'm like, is that not the same exact advice we're giving? How is that different? Like, I just think you think people are fishing so much for this women's specific thing that, you know, I get it's a marketing tactic and things like that and blah, blah, blah. But when you fundamentally look at like what, like women respond to cardiovascular training, women respond to high intensity training, women respond to resistance training, like it's the same baseline, like things that you're inputting in the system. And then of course, at an individual level, you're adjusting those inputs and how much, how frequency, how intense, how easy, all of that stuff needs adjusted. But really, like that comes down more to individual differences, right? Like a low fit woman and a high fit man are not going to have the same training program. Just like a low fit man and a high fit woman, I can handle more volume than a lot of dudes that I know, right? And that's, I'm not fragile and incapable and need to be low intensity because I'm a woman. No, I have a really high baseline fitness status. I've been an athlete for 20 years. Like, that's very different though than the woman who's maybe coming in and never really trained and never really exercised. And it's not like me and her are going to have the same program just because we're women. We're going to adjust it to that baseline experience, capacity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the same applies to men. I think the message that gets lost in that, though, is that a lot of people, what they're trying to say is women haven't strength trained or power trained or, you know, appropriately approached cardio that wasn't that like death by fire, fat loss, burning craziness that women tend to do. And that we need a more sound approach of that is just good training principles, though. It's not women specific. It's just what good coaches or athletes have always done.
Yeah. Looking at recovery, looking it's classic volume
and how much you've been kind of like sports specific training, you know, everyone has to, you know, we have to individualize. But there are some differences that I, you know, you said there's no differences, but the female oriented stuff is more expensive, you know, because they have to put the pin packet on it. Right. And and it's, you know, it's geared more towards to try to take advantage of the vulnerable population. Yeah. So,
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, I can give you guys a great researcher that I've connected with online who's doing research on like the messaging in social media and women and how it's viewed and interpreted. And there's a lot to being said of like content that like comes in and says like, you know, like especially with like birth control use and the scariness around that or menopause, we see it or the menstrual cycle. Like if they come in and they're like, you've been left out and ignored, like a lot of women have felt that way. So they go, okay, like, well, you, what you're saying must be true and correct. Like, and it is manipulative kind of versus like, you know, yeah, I like, for example, I sell programs, but I would make a lot more money if I had just positioned myself as the Pinkify fitness coach rather than the hybrid fitness coach, right? Like I could have made, any women, I get asked me all the time, like, will your programs work for menopause? I'm like, well, we strength train, we do cardio, and if you can handle it, we'll do some power training. Like, guess what? You're going to build bone, muscle, strength, longevity, cardio, all the buzzwords, whatever it is. It doesn't have to be Pinkified for it to work, but it's at that point where women are like, is this for me? And you're like, yes, it is for you.
All right. So tell us, what's the difference between premenopausal, perimenopausal, postmenopausal, and training?
Again, I wish there was this big, sexy difference. The only thing that I would say is that if you aren't thinking about your future and you're in your 20s, 30s, start thinking about your muscle and your bone, especially if you're sucked into like the skinny talk rabbit hole and you're neglecting that. You know, you should be focusing on building that because that's like teens, 20s, into 30s, peak building years are starting to decline years. So like, let's focus on those things. But then when we get to 40s, 50s, 60s, it's like, okay, age is happening. There's overlap of that with menopause. We're going to focus on maintaining or building those things. So like the approach really isn't that different. There's no specific menopause program. I think the narrative, again, to what I was saying earlier, is that most women who get to their 40s, 50s, 60s, perimenopause, menopause, they never trained like that. So it feels new and it feels specific. And so what I say is that it's not a magical program. It's that if you neglected it or didn't do it before, now its importance becomes like even more important, right? Like if that's usually what I try to explain to women, but like what you're, the approach you're taking, again, isn't drastically different other than a woman who shows up at 45 and wasn't an athlete her entire life is going to approach that maybe a little bit differently than someone who's 25 and has a little bit more training experience. And then the biggest thing with like peri to postmenopause is one, perimenopause hormones are crazy. They're all over the place. Your energy levels, your mood, your perception of tolerance might change and vary day to day, and you should work with that. You know, there might be potentially like a lot of women report and we see some early data suggesting like recoverability might be a little bit harder or lower. We might feel more joint, tendon, ligament, pain, injury stuff. So well, maybe we're being more appropriate with spacing high and hard intensity days with easier days. Maybe we need to be more strategic about when things are high and hard or tense versus easy kind of thing. It's not that intensity or hard is bad. We need that. We need that stressor because ironically, you also still see that you need that for that adaptation, right? So that's where some of those nuances lies, that you might have to learn to adjust day to day on the fly a little more than like across your cycle adjusting, right? Because you might have more of that chaos in that perimenopausal period mixed with your recovery might start to feel poorer. And some of that might be due to hormone shifts, changes, but also sleep is really impacted during that phase of life. And that can impact these things. And so I think it's where it gets messy for women in that period of time, because it's not just hormones equal this. It's hormones, aging, lifestyle, all one big overlapping Venn diagram that kind of impact what's going in your system. So it's really a matter of just learning how to work with your body day to day and then recognizing that maybe you were a high level athlete your entire life, but maybe you can't handle the same kind of frequency at intensity, and breaking that up or being more strategic about it or building in that rest and recovery based off what you need or now how your body's responding. But that's not always, like, a lot of women are starting this training at that period of life, and that's not the conversation that they need. It's just how to even get started and approach it. So again, who are you talking to when you're talking about that, right? It's not one size fits all.
Love it. What about body composition changes that occur regardless of training? And we'll get into that.
It's a menopausal transition of body composition, because there's something to that for sure.
Yeah, there is. And this is where I think sometimes stuff gets lost in, like, the internet confusion of people are, like, trying to correct all this information, but women don't know some of that, like, really fundamental baseline in between stuff. And I think that's where they get confused. And I sympathize with that a lot. Which you guys, I mean, you guys are, like, the body composition, like, masters. So that's not at you or anything like that. But in general, what I see him, that's true. He's great.
That's why I hired him.
Yeah, he's really good. And he's a really good researcher. So I sympathize when they're like, so what is actually happening or not happening? So we hear the cliche statistic, everyone slaps it on a reel, 3 to 8% of your muscle mass starts to decrease per decade if you don't continue to train it. And that is true. For men and women, we see kind of these linear, similar patterns, loss in lean mass, which is just a fancy way of saying, like, muscle mass, connective tissue, and or bone, your non-fatty tissues in your body, starts to kind of linearly decline for everyone starting in your third or fourth decade of life. Now, how fast that happens, of course, can depend on your training, if you're keeping your, you know, preventing it, blah, blah, blah. We can talk about that in a second. And that's true for everyone, right? And there's not some magical, like, women are rapid, more faster, things like that. And so when we then, though, look at, like, the fourth decade of life, fifth decade of life, or perimenopause transition, you know, we don't see this, like, actually, like, rapid decrease in muscle size. A lot of people are saying, like, oh, you're losing muscle mass, and you are probably from your 30s on. And if you continue to not train and keep up with it, you're going to notice that more meaningfully when you get to, as you're getting older. But for the most part, you do see, though, a change in body composition that is largely driven by increase in subcutaneous adipose tissue, which is a fancy way of saying you see more belly fat. Women tend to store more fat in their glutes, their hips, their legs. You do have it in your abdominal, but not quite as much. And you'll see a shifting upwards of that. So you get that quote unquote, like, menopause belly that women happen to hate, and then increases in visceral adipose tissue, which is, like, the big buzzword of, like, scaring women of saying, like, this. And it is the more inflammatory muscle tissue, like, or adipose tissue. It isn't ideal, but we see increases in that central adiposity during this period of time. So that is true. We do see that. So we see this general decline in body composition, right? Potentially either muscle mass is staying the same or slightly declining relative to adipose tissue. And then women tend to report somewhere around 5 to 10 kilos, I think is what the Swan studies quote. I could be off by that. Across, maybe it's 5 to 10 pounds. I think it's more confused.
Because it's not that much, yeah. but it's a slight amount. That is true.
It's maybe only 2.5 to 5.
Yeah. Plus the areas of where.
Because I think it's 2 to 5 kilograms. Something.
Yeah. 2 to 5 kilograms. Okay, yeah, then I'm doing that.
Like a few percent.
It's like.
It's okay.
Yeah. But the concept.
You am I using?
A little bit of weight gain and a more visceral transition. Yep.
Yeah. So we see a little bit of it, right? But I think what a lot of women are experiencing too is lifestyle catch up on top of this all together, which magnifies it more extremely than maybe they realize, right? Because I think there's this, you know, I alluded to it earlier, you're also aging. So not only is this stuff associated with menopause, the transition, and yes, some of it is, like, the changes in fat is really typically associated with menopause hormone shifts. Like, that is pretty predictable. But then, like, adding back estrogen doesn't necessarily make it go back or be better. So it's not like this, like, magical fix-all. It's not like estrogen is the main player here, right? But you're also aging, which these things we see in men as well as everyone as we age. There's just this overlap of them in between. But typically, we do see these changes, shift towards central fat, increases in visceral adipose tissue, declines in body composition. Muscle mass doesn't seem to be changing more meaningfully during that period due to menopause specific, just you're aging, so you're going to continue to see this linear decline. And I think that's what we're, you know, as much as we want women to be like, train for function, train for health, train for longevity, at the end of the day, they're really, really stuck on this body composition thing. And it feels really frustrating because it is real and it is valid and it is happening.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good explanation. I guess the question is, it goes back to, what do you do about it?
Right. I mean, I will say from a hormone therapy perspective, there are these studies that kind of show a little bit of a mitigation of it when people are on menopausal hormone therapy. But again, for a variety of reasons, the data I'm familiar with show that, with the sudden loss of estrogen in my world, you know, we talk about bones all the time. So there is a sudden, loss of bone density. And and there is, at least according to the studies, I see a little bit of an acceleration in the fat-free mass loss, relatively speaking. But like you said, kind of in the big picture, you know, it's all these things going on at once. And you alluded to it earlier that in menopause, if you're having symptomatic menopause, you know, like climacteric symptoms, well, you treat it, but the sleep issue. And so, I would just say this is my little thing to throw in there for the PSA for all the females out there listening. If you're going through menopause and you're having symptoms, hot flashes, you're not sleeping well, you're having all these things, talk to your doctor, talk to us, leading impulse of hormone therapy. We have non-hormonal therapies if necessary too. So, all right. And now what? Workout.
And I was going to say, there is like also to that, because it's like, even if we're not seeing this like super direct effect, like I think this is what's really hard for women, is that there's all these indirect things. Like we have some preclinical and like small, this is postdoc work they did before I got there, where like essentially estrogen suppressed mice or estrogen suppressed women start to show less spontaneous physical activity. So like you could be not spontaneously moving as much as your neat, as everyone likes to talk about. Yeah. Might be less, and you might not be registering that you're moving less because it's not subconscious, right? Yeah. You're not aware of it, so you might be moving less, and then that can be contributing to like a lack of an energy expenditure or deficit across the day that you're used to having as standard at baseline. Then if you magnify that with, well, you've been losing muscle linearly since your 30s, maybe there's a slight acceleration in it, and then changes in other metabolic parameters coming with this. Okay, well, maybe you're not as good at handling substrates. Maybe you're not as good at having that, metabolic burning fire, fat burning engine that you, so to speak, you have insulin resistance coming up or all these things. It just, there's all of this other compounding stuff. It's not just like one thing happening at once. But to your point is that also like so many women don't realize that if they are sleeping really poorly, that's going to change appetite. That's going to change like how they feel for their workouts. That's going to change energy. That's going to change so many of those inputs and outputs in the system. And it's very real. I think when women hear people say like things aren't changing, they're like, whoa, you haven't lived it. I'm like, yeah, I haven't lived it. But also like that is valid. That is real. That is true. And those things impact sleep-deprived women in their 30s when they are postpartum, right? Or grad students getting up at 3 a.m. to come to the lab. Like I gained weight in my PhD by doing that. Like I'm full transparency. So I really think women sometimes don't realize how much this stuff is indirectly impacting like the inputs they're putting in, which then like rapid fires everything else that's happening. If they like, then they say, I haven't changed anything. Everything's the same. But if you're sleeping half as much, half as quality, you're changing how you're eating. You don't realize that you're not moving as much. Like there are maybe some things, and that sucks when it's like not things that you are actively controlling or aware of the fact that you're kind of controlling and putting them in the system. But there's not doom and gloom, right? Like I think you guys talk about this probably in other episodes of your podcast. Like you can still do the same basic things of like energy manipulation. I hate when people are just like, it's just an energy deficit, bro, because it's like sometimes I think that goes right over people's heads. But like you can still adjust the inputs of nutrition in the system, adjusting either the quality of food, the composition of the diet, the amount that you're doing. I think a lot of women, they do start to see that, like, I just basically starve myself with a whiff of air and coffee every day for my 20s and 30s, start to backfire a little bit here more for them. And they have to both deal with the body composition changes while also learning how to, like, eat protein and eat fiber and feed themselves a little more balanced for the first time ever. And that feels really overwhelming because it's like, how do I get this much in? How do I make all these changes? And it can feel like a lot all at once, but we can drive that, right? And then also from the exercise standpoint, I mean, which is more my bread and butter, you can do the things that you were either not doing in your 20s and 30s that everyone has been suggesting that you do your entire life, or you can do the things that we know for aging that we're seeing for men and women across the board and in menopausal women work for preserving muscle, bone, and or contributing to improved body composition, with also, the caveat of like, women get really upset when I say this because I'm 32 and they're like, you can't say this, you're young and you don't know anything. It's like, part of it is you are aging, and you can't remove the variable that things are changing entirely. Like, I think a lot of women want to learn the secret, or they want the research hack of like how to go back 20 years. And it's just, it's going to come for me. It's going to happen for me. Like, it's not like I'm unaware of that, but like, there's not like a magical switch that you can change that at 60, you have the body composition you did when you're 15. Like, you're just not going to do that. But what you can do is still put the inputs in the system that we know work for slowing things down, preserving things, maintaining things, or even building things as we continue to age or go through menopause.
It's peptides. It's we got two
illegal, unauthorized, unstudied peptides, no less. So,
okay. Yes. Rep ranges. Let's hear it. Rep ranges, do they matter? I want to know.
Reps are. People don't know what reps are. Repetition.
Yeah.
The
age-old argument here. So essentially, rep ranges are how many times you move a weight during a specific lift. And we'll just use a squat here for general understanding. So say you're going to the gym and you're doing squats. The old school thinking is that like 1 through 5 is strength. And then like 6 or 8 through 15 is hypertrophy, or like 10 to 12 is the classic range there of hypertrophy. Mm-hmm. And then 15 through 30 is in muscular endurance. And there's these like hard cutoffs. And with all things fitness and exercise, there's never like these hard cutoffs where your body goes, oh, wait, we're doing something. Same thing. Like you see this with zones too. It's not like your body goes, oh God, wait, we crossed over the line, panic. Like there's a lot of blur between all of these, right? Wow. And for women, first of all, what is it? Self-reported, like 70, 80, 90% of women aren't even engaging in resistance training. So first off, whatever pretty reps much. You are doing is great if you're just doing them at all. Yep. So that's, first off,
that's,
for
that's hormones, the key. Boom. That's I'm done now. That's all I need.
Yeah. So like when we think of these arguments, I'm like, what are we doing? Like we're confusing the 80% of women who aren't even engaging resistance training and already feel like it's a barrier because of, you know, I covered a study once a couple weeks ago in a post that was like a lot of women's reason they're not lifting is because they feel confused, overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. They don't know where to start. So like, let's make it worse by telling them that the most accessible form of lifting, pointless, like don't do it. Waste of time. So you're doing these repetitions. And so from range of like 1, which is more strength in nature, to 30, which is hypertrophy endurance in nature, it's more of like a gradient.
A continuum.
You guys, a continuum. Yeah, there's overlap between these. Of course, when you get to the lower end of the spectrum, you are working at higher percentages of something known as your one rep max, which is like the max effort. Like if you go to the gym and do like the heaviest back squat you could ever do, which is like a powerlifting or like more serious lifting thing, it's the percent of like that maximal effort you can do. When you get closer to that and you're working above 70, 80, 90% of that, it is a little bit more strength. It's more of a skill and you have to practice that. It's, you know, it's more something that is, you train it by doing it and your body getting used to recruiting the muscle fibers needed for that kind of output. But that doesn't mean there isn't strength components to any of the other rep ranges across the spectrum. They just become specific to those rep ranges. And the key here with all of this is that it's not just reps. That's a lot of women get hung up on like, how many reps do I do? I don't really care how many reps you do other than preference or whatever. I care more about how hard you are taking those reps. Because, you know, for example, you're doing your squats in the gym. If you're following a program and it says 3x10 squats right there in that middle moderate range, which is where most programs are going to put a lot of people, is that 10 to 12 range. And I think that's great. Yeah, I think that's great for women listening to this to feel confused, because when you go lower, there's that skill and strength component and confidence component you might not have. Over time, you can work towards that. But like, yeah, I don't think any woman should go to the gym on day one and do a 3x3 lift, because you're probably going to start more in that middle to moderate or high rep range because it's a little more accessible. It's easier. Like it's also like, you can kind of underload it and realize you're underloading it and build back a little bit more slowly. And then over time you can work towards that higher skill stuff. But when you think about this, think about effort. And when I talk about effort to women, when they've ever been heard this before, other than like, how hard can you push a group fitness class until you want to vomit kind of thing. And it's similar to that, but not. So think about if you're in the gym and you're doing your back squat and you're doing a set of 10, you would want that 10th rep that you do to feel somewhere around like a 7 or 8 out of 10 effort. Now, most of you do not know what that feels like because you never felt what a 10 out of 10 feels like. Another way of thinking that is that if you kept going, if you did it and then you said, okay, I think I'm there. And I said, okay, keep going until you can't do a single another rep. you should be able to do 1, 2, 3, maybe 4-ish reps more, and then you wouldn't be able to do it anymore. Now, the back squat is not the lift to go test this with. Maybe do like a bicep curl or a leg press or something a little more controlled. I'm just using the back squat as an example here to learn what failure is. Because that knowledge of where failure is helps you figure out how close everything else needs to be to that. And so one of the things I love telling women is take an exercise that you feel safe doing with and take it to failure so you can feel what that actually feels like. And what you'll probably notice are a few things. One, you have to actually focus while you're doing it. If you're going to the gym and you're looking around and you're distracted and you're going through the motions and you can kind of like not have to think about the lift that you're doing while you're doing it, like intensity breeds and focus. So if it's intense enough, you should have to kind of focus on how is your body moving, the bracing, the breathing. Now, if you're in there on day one, you're going to be like Bambi on his first day on earth. You're going to feel a little awkward. That's okay. I'm talking about like over time, as you get used to it, gain the skill. The second is going to be, you'll notice that as you say you do those 10 reps, around 6, 7, 8, they're going to start to slow down. If you don't notice that your reps start to slow down a little bit, you probably can go heavier. They should slow down towards the end of that, but you don't need to stop when it slows down. Usually it starts to slow down and you have a few more reps after the slowdown before you get to that like, oh, I'm a couple reps shy of failure because it's just harder. You're recruiting more muscle fibers. Key note here on this argument of like high versus low, you're getting closer to that proximity of failure. So your body's having to recruit more to produce the same amount of force, which is great for hypertrophy and strength and power and all of that. And so the next one is if you're doing multiple sets, if you feel like you do an exercise, you look at your watch, you look around and you could either do a set of burpees or go right back into the exercise that you did, you probably didn't go hard enough. You might not need a super long period of time of rest, but you should feel that you need at least like a minute and a half, 2 minutes between heavier, harder compounds. And then maybe about a minute or so with like more accessory, tiny muscle groups, maybe like the bicep curls or tricep extensions type things between those. So you could actually reproduce the same work or weight or force that you did in the prior set. That effort is more important than a specific rep range. And we have data that shows that upwards to like 30 reps or as low as 30 to 60% of that one rep max, as long as it's taken within those few reps shy of failure or like 80 to 90% of what you could do in the max attempt, you are getting most of the same benefits for hypertrophy and or strength relative to the rep range that you're doing, right? If you want to get better at a one rep max, you should practice a one rep max. But if you just are training to develop muscle, get stronger, you know, build these fibers up that you maybe neglected for years, it doesn't matter. The only caveat is that if you're doing 15, 20, 25, 30 reps, it is harder to take yourself to that failure because you might get bored. It's a lot of reps. They take a long time. So it's not that they're bad. It's just there's more room for error there on truly taking them to failure. But if you are just starting out and all you have is bands, your body weight, a few lightweights in your home or a corner of your gym or wherever you're at, and you are, maybe you're working at 20% of your one rep max and you're at 20, you know, you could do your 6 rep shy of failure or whatever it is, like that's fine for starting. You don't need to start at this level. You can start a little bit lower and ease in and build up to that over time. It's not like you have to do this on day one, but it's the effort that matters more. And I think that effort conversation is the one that is left out the most for women because they never were truly taught how to lift, how to train, what hard feels like. And that's why they feel frustrated when they don't see body composition changes or they're not seeing results or they're not feeling like it's working. Because they're kind of going through the motions, which is fine if that's all you want to or willing to do or you're starting, versus the body requires stress in order to adapt. So it has to be stressful enough. So it's not a magical rep range. Everyone's arguing this rep range. Yes, it's important to lift heavy relative to your skill level, the rep range that you're doing, and the goal that you have. As long as you are doing that, you are mostly all of the way there. And I'll stop ranting now.
This doesn't matter if you're a guy,
yeah,
girl,
baby,
premenopausal, perimenopausal,
elderly,
postmenopausal.
Yeah.
Teenager, prepubescent, whatever it is, like this
90-year-old.
You know, there's this, it's not like, I say this all the time, you know, women aren't small men is the saying that, but they also aren't, like they aren't a different species is what I like to say.
Oh, that's
it's not like if you take, it's not like if you take female muscle fibers from a mouse or a human. And it's like, oh, women actually don't respond to mechanical tension at all. It's a totally different mystery thing. We don't know. Like, it's like these basic fundamental physiological adaptions and responses work. And we see as we replicate some of these studies that were done in men, and we're replicating them in women, and we're seeing, do I think we should replicate studies and confirm if we have no idea? Yeah, that's great. Amazing. Do research on women. But like, we can't just shape this narrative that like, oh, the research is going to come out something totally different. Because when we replicate it, we see women adapt to the stress of exercise when the stress of exercise is appropriate.
Spencer, I think that's a good title for this podcast. Women may not be small men, but they're not different species.
That's a good one.
That's one of my token sayings.
Well, we'll give it to
I love it. All right, we're going to have to quote you on that, Ben.
How about some rapid
fire like myths that you've needed to bust lately? The working out in the morning, what you already kind of busted the big myth.
Well, we're talking a lot about lifting, so I'll talk a little bit, pivot to like the cardio thing. I'm known as the cardio girly, even though I'm a beefcake, but it's so funny because no one else talks about endurance and cardio. Women can do cardio. High intensity interval training, sprint interval training, great, fine. Might have a slightly different acute positive response, like tight new muscle fibers or body composition comparative to regular, but like both improve body composition compared to nothing. Exercise is not driving most of that, diet is. Both are safe, both are fine. Zone 2 is fine for women. It's not gonna kill you. It's not gonna raise your cortisol. You're not gonna die. The adaptation to endurance training across time actually improves your cortisol response to exercise. Like the first day you do it, it's going to be heightened and higher because it's stressful. The more you adapt, it's going to be lower. My favorite fun fact is that in continuous steady state exercise, if you are fed with adequate, you keep your blood glucose level stable, cortisol actually doesn't drift upward. So boom, bang, just eat enough before, during, after, depending on what your goals are. I'm trying to think what else I've had a bust. I've been doing
The cortisol thing. We've had like three episodes on cortisol because for the people out there, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter. Yeah. It's normal for it to go up. Yes, you need it to go up when you're stressed. If it doesn't, that's a big problem and you got to come see.
You're going
dying. Well, I don't think women are never taught about physiology or exercise of their bodies in this kind of way because it's not like said for women, but like they don't realize that like this cortisol, stress response to exercise is necessary. It's required. It's part of the adaptive response. It's part of what like stimulates the release of glucose and fats from storage so that you have them to burn during exercise. Yeah, that's a good point. It's like I get on my tangent of like, if you're so worried about it, just like train and adapt and eat enough. Yeah. And it's like, whatever. But like, it's necessary. It's required. Yeah. It's essential. Like it's not. The exercise that you do matters more for all the things you're worried about, what cortisol is doing for you. I think that's my like asterisk there for that with women is like, speaking to what I said earlier, is like, don't overdo drinking from the fire hose of like crazy intensity, 6 day a week, no break, no polarized training, no formal resistance training. You're just like drinking from this fire hose of like, how many calories can I burn and how hard and intense can I feel like I'm working type thing. There's a grain of truth of like, maybe you don't do boot camp class 6 days a week, maybe lift 2 days a week and do boot camp class 2 or 3 days a week for your cardio training, and then like actually take a day off and maybe sleep a full night. You know what I mean? And like, you know, there is a grain of truth of women being overstressed and doing too much and burning the candle at all ends and trying to do more with exercise.
Oh, anybody.
That's exactly. And then it gets lost in the nuance of saying, well, that stuff's spiking your cortisol and making you fat and it's going to kill you. And you should just hawk for a walk in Pilates. And we're like, we are overcorrecting. We're overcorrecting way too much. More so it's women just need good exercise programming. Like that's the gap. That's the gap. They just need good exercise programming. It's not like a special plan. It's not a magical plan. It's just that you've never been given a good plan. Shameless plug for me if you want me to like say Alyssa is a shill for what she does. But like, please. There's a million programs out there, right, that do this, right?
First method.
Yeah, woo. But like, you just need good exercise training and you've never experienced it. And that's why you see these women who, when they start formally lifting or doing more like athletic training, they're like, oh my God, this was life changing. Cause you see all the results of everything you ever wanted before. And it's a lot more fun too. So other things that I've been debunking, I've been doing this post series on the mass versus quality thing. I just posted the second one today. Yeah, there is some cool data looking at, you know, muscle mass might be not super linearly related to menopause, but there's some interesting new studies like just recent, like in the last year coming out, looking at like, there might be like a little bit less quality. There might be a degree of truth to that when it comes to like neuromuscular output and or, you know, they do ultrasound echo looking at like fat infiltration and or fibrosis. Like there might be some truth to that. But then again, like, we're saying this to women, but like, what is the response to that? Well, you strength train appropriately at a high enough intensity with enough frequency for adaptation. And maybe if you are interested, willing, or want to do some power plyometric or some sort of like, you know, not just traditional strength training with that, if you're open to it, right? Like, if you want to cover all your bases, like, but the application isn't some magical specific muscle quality program. It's just like, do the same things that we know. And we, you know, hopefully we get studies where we have interventions and we see how much they combat this or reduce this, or they're not just cross-sectional studies comparing groups, right? But at the end of the day, like, the same response is sleep enough, eat enough protein, and strength train, right? Like, the application is still going to be the take home of like the big rocks of what you should be doing. I don't know.
How about time of the day? So this goes to the kind of cortisol thing. So we tell people the best time of the day to work out is when you're actually going to do it. But people out there that you've had to debunk have said, oh my God, don't work out in the morning, because that's when your cortisol is highest. And we've tried to debunk that.
But then you see the people saying to work out in the morning when it's high, because it's high and it will take advantage of it being high. And I'm like, oh my God. This is a stretch.
Don't listen to anybody talking about cortisol and this has got a problem. You see an endocrinologist. The people even talking about cortisol are not screwing
us. It's not even the cortisol. There's no certain genetics of chronotypes of.
Well, there's some new genetic to that, but basically just work out when you know you're going to get it in.
Yeah, I mean, and the only caveat I'll say to that is, like, I know some women, especially in like peri-postmenopause, they might find that if they work out late at night, it impacts their sleep. They feel more sensitive. Right. Yep. Then don't adjust it, move it, or see if there's things that you can do to wind down or separate that or break that up that can reduce that for you. Like, if that is your experience, then do it in the morning, early afternoon, whatever that looks like. I think there's a hierarchy of things for people, right? There's, you're either going to not do it at all, or you do it when you can. Great. Mm-hmm. Do it when you can. Do you have specific performance goals or whatever goals? Well, maybe you're thinking about, when can I do that when I feel the best and I'm going to have my best training session, or I can get enough food in me that I feel good before I do it, kind of thing. But I fall into both of those groups. I squeezed a lift in this morning in like 30 minutes in my PJs before coming on this podcast, because it just had to get done. It wasn't perfect, but like, I'm training for a race right now. So on Saturdays, I'm going to be more specific about, like, let's line this up with like eating and timing and when it's more optimal for me to like get that done, because I care about that specifically right now. And you can kind of pick and choose where that fits for your life. But like, getting it in matters more than any special time of day, unless you have some sort of adverse experience. But also, even a really bad workout at the most unideal time is better than no workout at all. Like, it's just perfect. The take home.
Yeah. A breath of fresh air with Loveless Method Doctor.
I try.
I love it. Well, I think that kind of consistency and all that stuff is what we like to preach here. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
Friends, family, anybody, make sure you share this with someone who's confused about training methods throughout the different sexes and changes you go through life in women. So if you don't follow Dr. Alyssa Alenik, make sure you do that. We'll put her up in the show notes, and make sure you check out the List Method.
Did you say you have a book too? The List Method a book or not?
It's a program online.
It's just a program.
It isn't, but I would stay tuned for some exciting news, but it's not public yet.
Okay, I thought there might be something to that. Okay.
There might be something coming soon.
Keep your finger on the pulse.
Yeah, keep your finger on the pulse.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Thanks. I'll make sure you also go give us a rating. Again, always give us a 5. If not, don't rate us. Please do not do that. We need all the help we can get. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Dr. Alenik.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Here's our outro. If it will play.
I can't hear it.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.